Welcome to this presentation on the management of acute myeloid leukemia. I am Dr. Amir Fathi, the Director of Leukemia Program at Massachusetts General Hospital. Today I will review the management of higher risk as well as relapse and refractory AML and where research development is headed for this disease. Specifically in this presentation, I will describe the emerging role of FLT3, IDH1 and IDH2 inhibitors in AML, and I will discuss the paradigm for non-intensive upfront treatment of older or less functionally robust patients with this disease. These are my disclosures. Let us start with some statistical information regarding acute myeloid leukemia. These are the most recent numbers for patients with this disease. There are approximately 20,000 new cases of AML in the United States every year, and a large proportion of those patients also die from their disease. Importantly, the median age of AML is 68 and appears to increase every year as our population also ages. So it is important to note that approximately half of patients with AML are in their 70s and 80s, an age group which is also impacted by other comorbidities as well as overall functional decline. This is an important issue, especially when considering options for treatment and more intensive versus less intensive approaches to the therapy of this disease. The traditional prognostication of AML is presented here. This has not substantially changed over the course of the last two decades. There are certain factors that are patient-specific, such as the patient's age, as well as their other comorbid conditions. In older patients, generally speaking, other comorbidities may impact the ability of the clinician to treat the patient intensively with chemotherapy. These comorbidities may include cardiac dysfunction, renal insufficiency, hepatic disease, functional limitations. All of these things can limit the ability to provide intensive chemotherapy in patients with AML. There are also disease-specific factors to consider. Did the AML arise out of a preceding or an antecedent marrow malignancy, which may have been more indolent? If AML is secondary, meaning arising out of something else, it is oftentimes much harder to achieve remission with traditional treatment, as opposed to de novo AML, which means leukemia that arose out of a normal marrow. Also, there are other disease-specific factors to consider. The leukemic blasts may have certain cytogenetic abnormalities within them or certain mutations that may be poorer risk or better risk in terms of therapeutic response to upfront conventional treatment. So these patient-specific and disease-specific factors did go into the traditional prognostication of AML in terms of whether patients did well or did poorly with treatment. However, over the course of the last decade especially, there has been a range of developments in terms of understanding the complex underpinnings of the disease, specifically new mutations or mutations that have been there from the beginning, but newly discovered have come to our attention. These include IDH mutations, TET2 mutations, EZH2 mutations, as well as ASXL1 mutation. This complexity is also demonstrated here. If you look at the pie graph, you can see that patients with AML are not a homogeneous group. They're markedly heterogeneous, with small pieces of the pies demonstrating the different subpopulations of the disease with different molecular features. These molecular features contribute in a complex fashion to the genesis of AML, but also may provide targets for therapy, which we will get to in this talk. But before we do that, let's talk about the traditional approach to the treatment of AML, which unfortunately did not change for a period of almost four decades. The initial papers are presented here. As you can see, they occurred in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And the traditional treatment of AML generally involved two classes of chemotherapy drugs. One was called cytarabine, which is a highly effective chemotherapeutic agent, especially in acute myeloid leukemia, as well as anthracyclines. There are two that have been incorporated into induction chemotherapies, daunorubicin and idarubicin. Anthracyclines and cytarabine have been included together in various chemotherapy regimens that have been used to try and induce a remission, hence the name induction. These include 7 and 3 IA, as well as others that have been used across the country. Suffice it to say, these induction chemotherapy regimens are relatively similar in the rate of response that they lead to, and the rate of response is approximately 70 to 75% of patients. Patients with a new diagnosis of AML present and are oftentimes, if eligible or appropriate for intensive treatment, admitted to the hospital. They receive chemotherapy, usually over a period of 5 to 7 days. Their marrow empties as a result of that chemotherapy, and following that, there is a period of recovery and then assessment by another marrow biopsy to see if a remission has been achieved. So the first phase of treatment for AML is called induction, and the goal of induction is to achieve remission. The second phase of treatment, traditional phase of treatment, is called consolidation. The goal of consolidation is to achieve a cure. What is cure? Cure is 3 to 5 years of remission, an arbitrary definition. And therefore, the goal of consolidation is to prolong the initial remission achieved after induction, if we are lucky enough to achieve it, prolong it to a period of 3 to 5 years, at which point we can arbitrarily call a cure and move on from there. The likelihood of relapse at 3 to 5 years is very low. Consolidation can either be chemotherapy or it can be a bone marrow transplant. Generally speaking, for patients who have lower risk disease, we give consolidative chemotherapy, typically repeated cycles of high doses of cytarabine in an effort to eliminate any molecular residual disease left in the patient. But for intermediate, usually, and also almost strictly for higher risk patients as well, we use consolidative allogeneic stem cell transplant, since this is a more intensive approach at consolidation in an effort to eliminate any residual disease and to cure the patient. This was the paradigm, what I mentioned in the last two slides, for the traditional approach to the therapy of AML. Induction, hope for remission, and about 75% of patients achieve remission, followed by consolidation, either chemotherapy consolidation for lower risk patients or intermediate risk patients who do not have appropriate donors for stem cell transplant, or consolidative transplant for intermediate risk patients who have donors and for higher risk patients. The hope is to cure those patients. Nevertheless, with this paradigm of induction and consolidation, a large proportion of patients were either refractory to initial chemotherapy or, even if they achieved remission with induction, subsequently relapsed. And therefore, the likelihood of long-term remission and cure for patients with AML with this traditional approach has hovered around 25 to 35%, which is very suboptimal. We had not had substantial advances in the field until fairly recently, especially in the year 2017 and 2018. We've had multiple approvals for targeted therapies and novel approaches to the treatment of AML. These are listed here. Midostaurin was initially approved for use in patients with FLT3-mutated AML and appropriate for induction chemotherapy. Patients received induction with 7 and 3, and if they had a FLT3 mutation, midostaurin would be added on day 8. Enasidenib, the IDH2 inhibitor, and ivosidenib, the IDH1 inhibitor, have been approved for use in patients with IDH2 and IDH1 mutations, respectively, and who have relapsed and refractory IDH-mutated AML. The fixed ratio daunorubicin cytarabine liposomal drug called CPX351 was also recently approved based on phase 3 data for use in patients with secondary AML or MDS-related AML. And finally, the antibody drug conjugate gemtuzumab ozogamicin has also been FDA approved for use in certain populations in the upfront and the relapse refractory setting. Let's focus our attention on IDH inhibitors. In 2009, a publication in the New England Journal article first described IDH1 mutations in a subset of patients with AML. IDH stands for isocitrate dehydrogenase. Isocitrate dehydrogenase is a key enzyme in the Krebs cycle, and helps catalyze the conversion of isocitrate dehydrogenase to alpha-ketoglutarate, ultimately leading to the production of ATP. IDH1 mutations were initially discovered in AML, and a short time after, IDH2 mutations were also discovered. Both of these altered IDH enzymes do not lead to the classic enzymatic reaction we see with normal IDH proteins. Instead, the altered IDH1 and IDH2 proteins help catalyze the conversion of alpha-ketoglutarate to the oncometabolite 2-hydroxyglutarate, which leads to suppression of the key enzyme called TET2. TET2 is involved in the methylation of key genes that mediate maturation and differentiation of myeloid precursors. And when TET function is suppressed by 2-HG, which is built up as a result of the aberrant IDH enzymes, these normal genes are inappropriately hypermethylated and turned off, and the myeloid precursors no longer appear to mature and differentiate normally. Hence, the phenotype of acute myeloid leukemia and the accumulation of these precursor malignant leukemic cells in the marrow. 2-hydroxyglutarate can actually be measured in the blood, urine, marrow, and as a marker of disease in patients with IDH-mutated AML. Let us talk about the IDH2 inhibitor enasidenib in patients with AML. Enasidenib was studied in various populations of patients with myeloid malignancy, and a key cohort in the initial dose escalation and dose expansion studies looked specifically in patients with relapsed and refractory AML. These are patients who have gone beyond initial rounds of treatment, have either failed to respond or have relapsed disease following initial response, and now require treatment. These patients have received did receive on trial the IDH2 inhibitor enasidenib, and in this population at least, there was a fairly impressive overall response rate of approximately 40%, and a complete I'm sorry, a composite remission rate, not a complete remission, a composite remission rate that approximated 20%. And in this patient population, that is quite remarkable. Looking at all doses of the drug used on these trials, the same proportion of response was seen on study. These are the survival curves for patients with relapsed and refractory AML who had received enasidenib. As you can see, those individuals who achieved remission, and even those patients who did not achieve remission but had some degree of response, had a fairly impressive median overall survival. The patients achieving remission appeared to have a median overall survival that approached 20 months, which is quite remarkable in this patient population. And those non-CR responders also had a fairly impressive median overall survival of 14 months. Similarly, with the IDH1 inhibitor, ivosidenib, there was an impressive rate of response that can be demonstrated here, which was fairly similar to that seen in enasidenib respectively in the IDH2 mutated patient population. And again, those patients who had responses seemed to do better in terms of overall survival versus those who had no response. It is important to note that the traditional responses of remission CRI or CRH were not the complete picture when it comes to IDH inhibitors. In the dose escalation and dose expansion study of ivosidenib, transfusion independence was also seen across the patient populations treated with IDH inhibition. As you can see, a large proportion of patients treated achieved transfusion independence. Remarkably, almost all individuals who achieved a complete remission, but also those individuals who did not, even patients who had no response, a subset of them achieved transfusion independence, which is important in terms of quality of life in our patients with AML, many of whom with active disease require multiple visits to the hospital for transfusions. If we're able to eliminate the need for transfusions, we do have a very positive impact on the quality of life. IDH inhibitors have a unique toxicity profile. In general, they're very well tolerated. However, a subset of patients can develop symptoms and signs of what is called a differentiation syndrome. As was mentioned earlier, IDH inhibitors appear to inhibit the activity of the altered IDH enzyme. As a result, 2-HG levels are suppressed, the block on differentiation is released, and cells again differentiate. Sometimes the differentiation can be quite robust and lead to a cytokine-mediated syndrome called a differentiation syndrome. This differentiation syndrome can have a relatively heterogeneous presentation, which can include unexplained fevers, pulmonary infiltrates, pleural effusions, rash, renal insufficiency. And in patients who are treated with IDH inhibitors, especially in those in whom there is evidence of differentiation in the peripheral blood and the marrow, there can also be a manifestation of a differentiation syndrome, which can be severe and lethal if it's not appropriately recognized. This particular figure is from a paper that was published to describe the differentiation syndrome associated with the IDH2 inhibitor enasidenib and represents a typical patient treated with the drug who experienced the syndrome. As can be seen in the top figure, this patient's peripheral blood after initiating enasidenib demonstrated a steady rise in neutrophils or granulocytes, which is a good response to treatment, especially in the peripheral blood. Concurrent with that, there was an increase in maturing granulocytes and myeloid precursors in the marrow. That's the middle part of the figure here, the green being the mature granulocytes expanding and the red being the leukemic blasts decreasing. But as one can see, concurrent with this, there was multiple episodes of differentiation syndrome, which for this patient included unexplained fevers and pulmonary manifestations. The gray vertical bar graphs demonstrate the three separate episodes of differentiation syndrome. Each episode was treated with dexamethasone, as well as the use of Hydrea, which was specifically used to manage any leukocytosis that occurred coincidentally with the differentiation syndrome. Differentiation syndrome does not have to include leukocytosis, but it oftentimes occurs concurrently with leukocytosis. This led to recommendations regarding the recognition of differentiation syndrome in patients treated with IDH inhibitors and the typical signs and patterns. Unfortunately, many of the signs and patterns of differentiation syndrome are nonspecific and can also accompany other conditions seen with patients with AML, such as infection, heart disease, and kidney disease. Secondary causes that may explain the signs and symptoms should be ruled out or at least treated effectively. But if the manifestation does not get better and is getting rapidly worse, empiric treatment with dexamethasone is recommended. And certainly if leukocytosis or an elevated white count is also occurring and moving and progressing rapidly, concurrent administration of hydroxyurea to control the white count is also recommended. Once the symptoms and signs of a presumed differentiation syndrome are improved on steroids, the steroids can be tapered over a period of days. And in fact, if this is differentiation syndrome that's causing these symptoms, steroids should lead to a relatively prompt response. Let's move on to FLT3 mutations and FLT3 inhibitor therapy in AML. FLT3 stands for FMS-like tyrosine kinase 3. It is a receptor tyrosine kinase, which shares similarities with other receptor tyrosine kinases known in human biology. There's an extracellular domain, a cell membrane domain, and an intracellular domain, which are a feature of these receptor tyrosine kinase. The alterations typically occur on the intracellular portion of the receptor tyrosine kinase. The most common mutation is the internal tandem duplication mutation, which affects approximately a quarter of patients with AML, the so-called FLT3 ITD mutation. Approximately 7% of patients have another type of FLT3 mutation called the TKD mutation, which are point tyrosine kinase domain mutations that also impact the intracellular part of the FLT3 tyrosine receptor kinase. When the FLT3 receptor tyrosine kinase is altered as a result of a mutation, it becomes less dependent on its ligand, the FLT3 ligand. As a result, the receptor becomes more active, and the cells receive an uncontrolled signal to replicate and divide. And patients with FLT3 mutations typically present with very proliferative disease and typically a monocytic leukemia. A series of FLT3 inhibitors have been studied over the course of the last decade. The first generation of these FLT3 inhibitors were relatively nonspecific and less potent. Among these was the FLT3 inhibitor midostaurin, which in monotherapy studies did not lead to any significant proportion of patients achieving deep responses or impressive rates of remission. However, in combination with chemotherapy, it appeared to be quite promising, ultimately leading to a large phase III trial that compared 7+3 with placebo with 7+3 with midostaurin. This study was conducted in younger patients with FLT3 activating mutations and combined midostaurin with induction, consolidation, and maintenance. These results were presented a few years ago, demonstrating a survival advantage in those patients who received midostaurin plus 7+3 as opposed to those who received 7+3 plus placebo. And this led to the first of a series of FDA approvals, specifically in patients with FLT3 mutated AML. As mentioned, midostaurin is certainly not the only FLT3 inhibitor in development. A second and third generation of FLT3 inhibitors is currently under study, and many of these drugs are much more potent and much more specific for the FLT3 receptor tyrosine kinase. Among these is the FLT3 inhibitor gilteritinib, which has been studied in various settings. As monotherapy in relapsed refractory AML, it leads to composite complete remission rates that hover between 35% and 45% in relapsed and refractory patient populations, and this is quite remarkable. A dose of 120 milligrams, and specifically doses above 80 milligrams a day, seem to lead to the highest rate of response, and this drug is currently under study for further clinical development. Quizartinib, another potent and selective FLT3 inhibitor, was also studied as monotherapy and has also been studied in combination with conventional chemotherapies. As monotherapy, this study was recently compared to other salvage regimens for relapsed and refractory AML, specifically FLT3 mutated relapsed and refractory AML. And in comparison to other salvage approaches, traditional salvage approaches, the FLT3 inhibitor quizartinib was recently shown to have a survival advantage in patients who have FLT3 mutated AML. Specifically, there was a 24% reduction in the risk of death compared to patients who received the traditional salvage chemotherapy for those patients who received quizartinib. The median overall survival was also significantly improved for patients getting quizartinib compared to those individuals receiving salvage chemotherapy. And salvage chemotherapy included traditional chemotherapy regimens such as low-dose cytarabine and FLAG. Let us move on to talk about novel combinations for older patients. As can be seen by this figure, as patients age, their outcomes in terms of survival are markedly worse. Many factors contribute to why patients who are older do worse in terms of AML. Patients who are older have a lower performance status. They're more likely to have substantial comorbid disease. Their disease specifically seems to have less favorable and a higher percentage of unfavorable molecular markers. MDS, a pre-leukemic condition that may lead to secondary AML, is more common in older patients, and secondary AML by itself has a worse prognosis. There is an elevated risk of therapy-related morbidity and mortality in older patients, a higher incidence of therapy-resistant disease, and because of all this, lower rates and duration of complete remission and a shorter median overall survival, and also because of the above, these patients are much less likely to be eligible for curative paradigms of treatment in terms of consolidation, which include bone marrow transplant. For our older patients, hypomethylating therapies have emerged as a less intensive treatment. These agents are better tolerated and have a lower rate of toxicity. They can also be administered in clinic. Hypomethylating agents at the doses that we generally use are thought to decrease the aberrant hypermethylation in genes that are key for differentiation and maturation and release the block on differentiation. Once the block on differentiation is released, those cells can mature, and therefore over time we see an improvement in the marrows of patients who are receiving treatment with hypomethylating therapy, and hopefully a reduction in blasts and an improvement in their transfusion dependence. Therefore, a substantial proportion of patients who receive hypomethylating therapies can have therapeutic responses, and a small subset can achieve remission. However, responses are often transient with leukemic progression and brief survival after initiation of therapy. A series of studies have looked at azacitidine and decitabine, which are the typical hypomethylating agents we use in patients with AML, and have compared them to traditional salvage approaches. In these studies, the rate of remission that has been seen in patients receiving hypomethylating therapy hovers between 18% and 35%. Given this relatively low rate of remission and suboptimal survival in our older patient population, many have wondered whether we can maintain the tolerability of hypomethylating agent therapy, but add to its efficacy, perhaps by incorporating and combining hypomethylating agents with targeted agents. Venetoclax is a novel and selective BCL2 inhibitor. BCL2 is an anti-apoptotic protein that is increasingly expressed in patients with AML. And as monotherapy, venetoclax seems to have a fairly modest response rate in patients with this disease. However, in combination with hypomethylating agents, venetoclax appears to lead to fairly prominent rates of response, specifically in newly diagnosed patients who are not induction eligible. The combination of hypomethylating therapy with venetoclax seems to lead to high rates of complete remission and complete remission with incomplete recovery in approximately 60% to 70% of patients. This rate of response is highly promising and was seen in early phase studies of the combination of hypomethylating therapy and venetoclax. Venetoclax is currently FDA approved for use in chronic lymphocytic leukemia and is available has been used by clinicians in the off-label setting for patients with AML in combination with hypomethylating therapy. Nevertheless, we are awaiting results of more advanced phase studies of the combination of hypomethylating therapy and venetoclax to determine whether the combination will be promising in the future. In early studies of the combination of venetoclax and hypomethylating therapy, there was definitely a substantial decrease in bone marrow blast burden in the majority of treated patients. And this leads to significant promise in patients receiving this combination. In conclusion, there is much promise in our field. There are improved outcomes due to better prognostication, patient selection, and supportive care. There is an emergence of effective and targeted therapies. Novel combinations for older patients appear to be emerging that enhance efficacy and maintain tolerability. But there's much more work to be done. The majority of patients with AML are yet to be curable or cured. Will the next decade see more approvals in terms of novel therapies for AML? That is yet to be seen, but I remain optimistic. Thank you so much for listening.